Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Paramedic Kevin Hazard has seen thousands of people as they really are. Many of his patients were too sick or too badly injured to put up any artifice. Others, it seems, simply didn't care to do so. He was tasked with saving their lives regardless, or at least with keeping them alive long enough to transport them to a bustling public hospital in Atlanta before cleaning out his ambulance and heading back out for the next call. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Hazard came to the job with an interesting background. He'd worked as a newspaper reporter, then delivered copies of the same paper to keep bread on the table while he wrote a novel, which was published. He signed up for a technical college EMT course almost on a lark, and then found himself curiously addicted to its messiness and improvisation and unpredictability. He did that job for 9 years. Kevin Hazard writes about the strange allure of emergency medicine in his new book, A Thousand Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. Kevin, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
What kind of person wants to be responsible for very sick people, not in a hospital, but in the completely uncontrolled conditions of the real world?
A weird one. You know, the truth is there's a, I think there are a lot of people who are drawn to sort of catastrophes, large and small, because there's a certain amount of freedom that's allowed to you in those moments. You know, when things go really poorly, then you kind of have no choice but to break the rules and kind of go off on your own. And, you know, there's a strange exhilaration to that level of freedom. And so I think that's a huge draw. And then, of course, the other thing is that there's a sort of an excitement that comes not only from the moment, but also knowing that you can handle the moment and that, you know, this is the worst day theoretically in somebody's life and that they, by chance, have found themselves in good hands.
Your origin story actually starts years before EMT school or paramedic school. You were leading people on jet skis on these tours, and there was an accident.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things I always used to joke about the tourism industry. You know, it's focused on families, and yet it's run by the opposite of family. You know, anytime you go on vacation, the people you see working there are not, you know, they don't have kids in a, you know, in a normal life. They kind of live this sort of pirate life. And that certainly was true of us. And, you know, like, I think it was summer of 97, and, you know, we're just two young kids leading this group of about 15 people on jet skis, and we were in the intercoastal waterway off South Carolina, and turned around, and next thing we know, we hear this thud. We look back, and these two guys had crashed into each other. And as I recall, they were kind of, a lot of people on jet skis, you know, they get on them and they're all over the place, you know, they're flying around. And so we were trying to calm them down to no avail. They eventually ran into each other, and one was really seriously injured. Essentially, he got thrown into water. His friend's jet ski jumped in the air and landed on him, and it hit him in the side of the face and more or less removed everything below his nose. My friend and I pulled up. You know, we were 19 in 120 feet of water. Nobody, no sort of help anywhere to be found. You know, and if they say the one thing to do in emergency is not to panic, well, we broke that one rule. At least I did. You know, I remember just freezing and thinking, this is it. You know, we're all going to die out here now. It was a horrible moment. Certainly not one that would lead you to think that I could handle this sort of career.
What does panic feel like in that situation? You said you froze. I mean, obviously, you guys eventually got the guy out of the water, right?
Yeah, it was a tremendously helpless feeling. And, you know, I used to see it in the eyes of bystanders all the time. You know, we would pull up to a call and someone just happened to be walking down the road when someone got hit by a car. Or, you know, the family member who's in the house when their dad runs a lawnmower over a nest of bees and starts having this horrible reaction. Hmm. You know, you see it in their faces, and it's recognition that something needs to be done immediately, but you're ill-equipped to do it. And that is, you know, perhaps the worst feeling that you could ever imagine. And so I just remember sitting there and looking at this guy thinking, my God, this, you know, I don't even know where we begin. By luck, there happened to be a boater driving by, and he had a two-way radio, and he said, let me call the Coast Guard. And so we just sat there. We floated in the water with this guy. We all had life jackets on. We just floated in the water with him, trying to keep him up, because he was sort of going in and out of consciousness. Eventually, the Coast Guard came and rescued him. And I remember seeing his feet on the deck of their boat as they were working on him. And just any sight of him just sent this, you know, sort of wave of terror down me. Just not only that I felt horrible that something so bad had happened to him. You know, I was scared to death that it happened in front of me, and that, you know, theoretically, you know, I was one of only a couple of people who could have done anything to help. It was, you know, it was really sort of, I think probably a lot of people have that moment. But it stuck with me, and I remembered thinking years later, you know, is that me? Am I that person that when things go wrong, can I not be counted on? You know, and it was really a nagging question.
When you were a professional paramedic, you were more than aware that there were certain true emergency situations that you would roll up on, and the family members, the friends, the bystanders, whoever had called you, really wanted you and your partner to run to reach the patient. And this is something that you were specifically trained not to do, but goodness, if someone is waiting for a paramedic, that's what you want from them. Why can't you hurry on the scene in that way?
Well, believe it or not, you're actually not trained to not run. Nobody ever addresses, at least, you know, nobody addressed with me, hey, when you pull up and people are panicking, make sure you don't run. Although once you get on scene and you realize immediately, oh my God, we can't run. And I think it happened for me the first time that I was still in training. So I was riding with people who were, you know, who were certified, and I was doing kind of like my internship, you would say. And they said, hey, go outside and grab a backboard. And everything was nice and calm. You know, it was a person in cardiac arrest, but still, relatively speaking, everything was calm. You know, people were upset, but the medics who arrived had a calming presence. And I went running out the door to get this backboard, and I grabbed it, and I ran back into the house. And by the time I got back, I mean, you would have thought a bomb had gone off in this place. And somebody pulled me aside afterward and said, don't ever do that again. You know, you have to be... These people are having a horrible moment, and when they see you, their impression is, okay, things have just gotten better. And when you're running around and you look nervous, then that veneer of calmness is immediately worn away. And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. I mean, yes, when an ambulance pulls up, you want them to jump out and run. But if they jump out and run, then that means they're hurrying and they're in a rush. And more times than not, it's a, you know, a medical emergency is a bit like an investigation. You know, someone's on the floor. Maybe you saw it. Maybe you didn't. Maybe you know what happened. Maybe you don't. Maybe this has happened before. Maybe it hasn't. But either way, this is its own unique situation. It needs to be addressed in its own methodical way. And otherwise, you're going to miss something. You may well could miss something that could save the patient's life. Or you might misinterpret the situation and do something inadvertently to kill them. I mean, you know, if you look at how a doctor proceeds in an emergency room, and luckily most of us don't get many chances to do that, you'll find that he stands back or she stands back, watches everybody, you know, get the patient set up. You know, they'll ask questions. They'll listen to the answers. They might ask somebody standing next to them, hey, what do you think about this? And they'll come to this sort of slow and deliberate answer. And that's the way it needs to be done. And, you know, unfortunately, working in EMS, it's not working in a hospital. You know, you don't have a security guard. You don't have a door with locks on it. You don't have a huge staff that can protect you. It's just you and your partner and every single person on that street. And if they don't like how quickly you're moving, you know, they'll turn on you in a hurry.
You describe your EMT school classmates as a room full of misfits. Why?
Well, I think people get into this job for any number of reasons. And plenty of them are good reasons. I worked with a lot of people who had wanted to do this their entire lives and were so happy to be there and work long careers. And there are people like me who didn't want to do it their entire life and for whatever reason stumbled onto it and had long careers that they were very proud of. But there were also people who got into it because, you know, maybe they're a landscaper or they own their own business. You know, I have a friend who was a sommelier and he was trying to start a restaurant, and he needed benefits. He needed a steady paycheck. You know, seasonal workers need something to do in the off season. And so there are people who enter it for all kinds of reasons. And the offshoot of that is that you know, you get this very strange mix of people. And on top of that, it's not a normal brand of medicine. You know, a brand new EMT makes $11 an hour. I'm pretty sure somebody at Starbucks is making awfully close to that. So what does that say about the person who's sitting in that chair? You know, does he really want to do that job? Quite possibly he loves that job. But how did he choose this one? He hasn't done it yet. How does he know he loves it? You know, how does the girl, you know, in the back of the room, how is she going to get by on $11 an hour? Who is she that you know, this is her life? And it's just a strange collection of people for all these different reasons. Some are good, some are bad, but, you know, we are by far not a unified face, nor are we, you know, generally speaking, you know, the most normal people in the room. It takes a strange person to do that job.
You found over time that the job was changing you. Certainly you were becoming more competent. You also had this sort of sense of gallows humor. And you would like make conversation with, I don't know, your mother-in-law or whatever about like what vehicle she would least like to be involved in a horrible car crash in. How did you start to realize, oh, there are things about my job that I just can't talk about in polite company?
The looks on people's faces. I have a very good friend from college who he was interviewed in the Washington Post because he was the first company commander to bring his company back to Iraq for a third tour. And I remember I told him this story, and it was, you know, it was a pretty gruesome story, but, you know, it had this sort of strange humor in it. And, you know, this is a guy certainly who'd seen a whole lot more than me. I mean, he was, you know, he'd gone to three tours in Iraq, and I told him this, and he looked horrified. And that was when I thought, oh, wait, I'm just talking about ordinary people living an ordinary life who found themselves in a really horrible situation. And that response that I got from him, I got over and over again. You know, people, we all can really relate to someone else's mortality because somewhere we know that's ours eventually. And so a story about somebody else's bad moment, you know, kind of hits home. And over again, I would tell these stories and people would kind of say, oh, gosh. And my wife would say, look, I know you and your friends know you. And we know how passionate you are about your job. And we know that you do a good job. And we know that you have a weird sense of humor. But not everybody does. Maybe you only tell the really funny stories.
There were other people that seemed to thrive, strangers. Thrive on asking you about the weirdest, most horrible stuff that you had seen. And you had kind of a complex reaction to this. You weren't offended exactly, but it was never a question, I gather, that you felt really comfortable with.
No, it wasn't. Yeah, I mean, there are some people that I worked with who, I mean, I worked with a guy who punched someone who asked him that question. You know, people really took that personally. In a lot of people's minds, you are you know, walking in uninvited into the worst memory that I have. I didn't quite feel that way, but it still struck me as a very strange question to ask somebody. You know, what's the worst thing you saw? And part of the reason that I had a hard time with it is because I found, generally speaking, that people didn't really want to hear the answer. As you got into it, if it was not either cinematic enough or too gruesome, they would walk away. And why get me into that moment if you're not prepared for the answer?
My guest is author Kevin Hazard. He worked for 9 years as a paramedic in Atlanta and is author of a new book called 1,000 Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with former paramedic Kevin Hazard. He's just written a new memoir called A Thousand Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Kevin, no matter what you learn in the classroom, it would seem that the only way that you can really learn to do this stuff is by doing it. Your first calls were terrifying when you realized this was you in charge.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes for a long first few months. I think somebody told me if you can make it 6 months, without killing somebody or being killed or just panicking and running off the job, then you'll probably make it. And, I think that felt about true to me. If you look at a physician, a paramedic is the only job other than a doctor where you have that much autonomy, where there's nobody supervising you and you're out making all the decisions for this patient's outcome. The only person who does that is a doctor. And a physician has at least, 2-3 years at least of an internship. Paramedic, you get about 4 shifts and then you're off. So, there's just no way you can train, but eventually you just have to get out there and do it and, hope that you memorized enough and that you're the kind of person who can stay calm enough that you don't make a huge mistake. And,
oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's tough. That the first few months are certainly the hardest.
You refer, this surprised me a little bit, throughout the book, you refer to patients that you're, on a call to get to as dead. You're called to try and revive them and save them. But I wonder about that term. Dead means dead. But what does it mean to you when you roll up on a scene and say, my patient's dead, but then you proceed to try to bring them back to life effectively?
Really, there's two kinds of dead. There is someone who's just dead, whether that's because they've been down for an hour or a week or a month, whether they've been, shot through the head or their head is gone, that's dead. And then there's what we would call cardiac arrest, which means essentially that your heart's not beating and you're not breathing. And that could, happen from anything. Eventually, that's what kills everybody, right? No matter how you die, it'll be cardiac arrest. That is the last thing that happens to you. Well, depending on the cause, depending how recently it's happened, you can reverse that. You can do CPR. You can pull out the defibrillator, the famous paddles, and shock them, shock their heart back into life, and you can bring them back. It's not easy. It's not necessarily likely, but it's possible. And so there's dead, and then there's someone who's in cardiac arrest, both ultimately dead, but one at least has a chance.
How many calls did you run before it occurred to you that you had forgotten some?
Almost immediately. The details, my first day, I still remember them. I remember every call I ran the very first time I ever set foot on an ambulance. I remember everything about them. And within a week, I would try to retell a story, and it didn't have the same, didn't have the same color. And you realize that the details start to fade because there's so, it's just an onslaught. It's like, drinking out of the fire hose. And I think I was probably at it for about 3 or 4 months. I switched partners, bumped into my original partner, and he was laughing and telling the story. Man, do you remember that night? And I didn't remember that night. And I'd been at it for 4 months. I'd probably only worked a few hundred people at that point. But it's, it's this onslaught. It's this constant wave of people coming at you. You can only remember just so many of them. And of course, when you catch them really late at night, 3-4 in the morning, you're at that point, your brain has kind of shut off. And almost everything that happens at 4 in the morning, you ultimately forget.
It's really interesting because, of course, that's probably, our psychology's way of protecting us if we do work like this, right, from truly being just crushed by the weight of it. On the other hand, there are things that you don't remember that literally are the worst day of someone's life, and yet the details have run together for you.
Yeah, it's, and that, I think, part of that is, it has to happen. You need to have a certain degree of professional detachment.
Yeah.
You know, if you've horribly broken your femur and I have to straighten it, it's really going to hurt you. And it's very easy as a person doing that to feel that pain and, you know, almost as if it's your own. And you have to block that out and say to yourself, look, it's going to hurt them, but it's not going to hurt me, so I just have to do it. You wouldn't be able to do your job if you didn't do that. I mean, you'd be horrible. Same time, you know, there's a level to how far you can allow that to go. And that, I think, is where your empathy starts to recede sometimes. You kind of need to constantly check yourself to make sure that, you know, that you haven't allowed yourself to become too callous, which is, you know, a constant risk for anybody doing this job.
There's a story that you tell in the book of needing a translator and not finding one. And you look around and there's a 9-year-old girl who's bilingual and you call her over.
Yeah, that's still one of those horrible moments. I'm glad she was there. I hate the fact that it had to come to that.
Tell us the story.
You know, essentially what happened, it was first thing in the morning. We had just gotten into work. And at that time, I was working days. It was about 7 o'clock. It was rainy, foggy. We get called to a Spanish-speaking trailer park in southeast Atlanta for a child who's down, which could mean anything. You know, generally speaking, people presume a child is sicker than they are. We got there, and this child had died overnight. And it happens, you know, unfortunately, it happens all the time. But, you know, one of 3 or 4 kids, they all sleep in the same bed. She was, you know, 3 or 4 months old. One of the older kids rolled over on her. She got tangled in the blankets, and that was that. Morning comes. Grandmother finds her. And when we got there, they handed the child to us. We knew right away. I mean, she was blue and she was stiff. That was that. But they kind of were walking in this, I don't know, almost this procession of mourning. People were kind of following the grandmother as she was grief-stricken and just stumbling forward through the trailer park. Somebody said there was a priest up there who could speak English, but I didn't see him. All I saw was, you know, 80 people sort of swarming around this woman. And we knew that the mother had been called and was on her way. And I wanted to make sure that the moment this woman got here, that she was immediately given the news. That she knew something was wrong. She'd already waited too long. I can only imagine what was going through her mind. You know, as a parent now, I can't even imagine approaching that and trying to figure out what's happening. And I wouldn't want to hear that news, but I would want it to be delivered quickly. And when we heard the car pull up, we heard the screech. We knew exactly what it was. And so I stepped out of the ambulance. And again, there was nobody anywhere near us except for this little girl. She was sitting there eating her breakfast, I think. And I said, do you speak English? And she nodded. And I said, is that the mother? And she said, yeah. And I said, all right, I need you to say exactly what I'm about to say. And so I told her that the woman, tell this woman that the baby was dead. And I impressed upon her, don't say passed, don't say gone. Say she's dead. You know, you got to be clear. And we have a tendency, you know, with good reason, to refer to death with all sorts of euphemisms. But that's not what somebody in that moment needs to hear. They need to hear with perfect clarity exactly what has happened. And so she did. She turned to her and in a remarkably clear and stoic voice for a 9-year-old delivered this horrible news to this grief-stricken woman.
I wonder how that day will figure into that girl's sort of concept of her childhood and her own life as she grows up and thinks back on it.
Yeah, you wonder that. You know, I think we all at some point have a first brush with mortality. I think I was in maybe 4th grade when somebody robbed a gas station down the street and shot the clerk with a shotgun. And we all knew it had happened. We were standing across the street as the cops were sort of surrounding it, and I imagine at some point the body was taken out, but I don't remember that. What I just remember standing there knowing that through that glass somebody had died and that people died, and sometimes they died terribly. And, you know, I guess that's a moment that a little bit of the childhood magic kind of gets brushed off. You know, and I'm sure that's exactly how it was for this little girl. You know, she didn't seem to be in any way affected by it, but, you know, I knew as I sat there talking to her that, you know, what a horrible thing I have to do here. What an unfair thing to have to ask this child to do, and, you know, ushering in the realities of life before they need to be.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Lindsay on the line in Dallas. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, how are y'all?
Great, thank you.
So I was wondering if EMS in Atlanta experiences a phenomenon that I see. I've worked in EMS in Dallas for the past 2 years, 2.5 years, and we get what people, white clouds and black clouds, where I'm a white cloud myself, where nothing ever happens to me when I'm on shift, you know. I worked for 2 years before I saw a cardiac arrest, before I worked one, you know. I have yet to work a motor vehicle accident, that sort of thing. Whereas I have friends who will, you know, encounter more terrible accidents on a daily basis, and those are black clouds. Do y'all have that sort of thing in Atlanta, too?
Oh, yeah, we have that that exact thing. I went back and forth. When I started my career, I was a white cloud, and nothing ever happened. And, of course, you know, as anybody would tell you, when you're brand new, you don't want to be a white cloud. You want to, on the one hand, you want the experience, but on the other hand, you know, you're here for these things. You didn't cause something horrible to happen, but you've dedicated yourself to figuring out how to deal with it. And so if it's going to happen, you want to be the one that gets called out to it. And I was a white cloud for a long time. And then I had a stretch where I was a black cloud. I had a month, a single month, where I ran 14 cardiac arrests. That's a lot. You know, and you have these stretches where it seems like every day somebody else is getting hit by a car or getting shot or something horrible has happened. And then 6-7 months will go by and you don't run anything but fevers. So, yeah, we definitely have the white cloud, black cloud phenomenon. And nobody experienced wants to work with a black cloud.
So in the field, on the scene, you are like literally a lifeline for people. And even if you are not able to help someone because they're too ill or too hurt, you're going to try. People trust you. Then you get to the hospital and it seems like you're instantly dismissed by the staff there who just don't necessarily respect your medical expertise or your judgment.
Yeah, you know, when you see it on TV, that the paramedics come in and there's this, you know, maybe even the doctor's waiting on the ramp outside, and, you know, there's this continuance of care and everybody's a professional and they're all looking at each other the same way. In reality, it isn't that way. You know, doctors, they tend to be kind of a force unto themselves, and, you know, hey, I'm not taking anything away from what they've done. Very smart people, an incredibly difficult job. It keeps changing. You've got to constantly work. But there's definitely, you know, a big chunk of ego that goes with that. And, you know, that filters down to the nurses who kind of have to shoulder the brunt of that. And the nurses turn to us as we're coming through the door, and that frustration lands on our feet. So some of it is just really busy people who kind of see, you know, they're trying to get rid of patients, meaning treat them and move them on, and we keep bringing more and more and more. So there's a naturally antagonistic relationship between us. But there's also the frustrations of an incredibly busy job. And then added to that, of the fact that we really do different jobs. You know, the paramedic's job is not to prepare the patient for the nurse, although sometimes I think some nurses feel that way. Flip side, you know, I think there are a lot of nurses who are very good at what they do, and sometimes they don't think that the paramedic who's coming in is doing a very good job. And in some cases, that's true. I've seen medics really come in and do a poor job, do a job I wouldn't want someone to do with my family or me, or certainly I wouldn't do with somebody else's family. You know, nurses remember that. So you can build a great reputation, and people will trust you, but that's not automatically the case. It's going to be, you know, between professional antagonism and, you know, the memories of people who screwed up before you. You know, you're going to have to come in and prove that you are worth listening to.
Part of your job involved preparing the ambulance at the start of every shift, and you discovered pretty early on that you were quite exacting about setting it up in a certain way.
Yeah. When you have a really, really sick patient, it almost never happens at a perfect time. It's never that, you know, the 115-pound person in perfect health who's sitting on a curb waiting for you. It's always this, you know, horrible approach to a, you know, steep driveway, 3 flights of stairs, a giant guy who's stuck behind the toilet in a very back bathroom, and who's, you know, 3 breaths from death. That does not allow you to, doesn't allow a lot of leeway. And so things need to be exactly where you want them to be, where you need them to be, where you expect them to be. And so everybody has their own, you know, sort of, I always refer to as a personal arithmetic that you set up for, or that you subscribe to for how you set up your ambulance, where things are, how many of them you think you need, how many, you know, what things you don't want and you kind of shove off to the side because, you know, I don't use that, or, you know, prepare some of the equipment so that when you had that moment where that person was gasping for air and, you know, they were swirling the drain and you knew this was it, so you didn't have to sit down and start assembling equipment. So I would try to get there 15 minutes early and have everything ready so that when we had that moment, I knew exactly where everything was and I could roll. You know, the inverse of that is I had a lot of partners. If we had to be there at 5 in the afternoon, they showed up at 4:59, sat in the front seat and said, "Are we ready to roll?" So,
yeah, how much does the dynamic with your partner affect the course of a particular day?
That's everything. You know, in the beginning and you don't know what you're doing, you just want your partner to be good. That's it. You know, I just want someone who knows what they're doing. And as you learn the job and essentially you can do it on your own, you say, I just want this to be somebody I can laugh at or laugh with. I want to have a good day. You know, imagine taking a 12-hour car ride with a stranger. And now imagine that once an hour, you got to jump out and complete this really difficult task. Well, add to that the fact that you can't stand this stranger with whom you are trapped in a car for 12 hours and with whom you are going to have to complete these difficult tasks and who you're going to have to rely on and who might be there again tomorrow. It's a weird thing. And, you know, people always refer to it as like, you know, it's my work husband, you know, it's Hazard. He's my work husband. It is a strange relationship because you rely on one another so much. You know, during the course of a call, that person is the only resource you have. You are each other's entire universe as you're running that particular call. You know, when you get yourself in these really dangerous situations where you really need that person and you lean on them, and that engenders an incredibly close relationship, or it can be really explosive and people wind up disliking each other. So that dynamic is everything.
My guest is author Kevin Hazard. He worked for 9 years as a paramedic in Atlanta and is author of a new memoir called 1,000 Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour to former Atlanta paramedic Kevin Hazard, who has just written a memoir called 1,000 Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. What's a perfect call for you, Kevin, or what was a perfect call at the height of your time as a paramedic?
Well, there was a time when I had a partner, and the two of us were actively seeking out what we believed to be the perfect call. And I think if you had asked us at that time what it was, it would have been the end of the world. Really what we wanted was for everything to go wrong, and for it to go wrong sort of fantastically, you know, and involve all sorts of different people and all sorts of different causes, you know, and it needed to be big, and, you know, there, you know, fires and explosions and, you know, maybe some people shot in a car wreck. And, but at the same time, you know, people who had, you know, some sort of medical injury. So I guess the ideal thing would have been a person having a seizure who wrecks a car and that hits a propane tank and that explodes and that scares somebody. And that guy just happens to be carrying a gun and he pulls a trigger and shoots someone by accident. And it sounds horrible. And, you know, but when you're sitting around all day sort of, you know, waiting for something to happen, you begin to wonder like, well, what's the best thing that could happen? And what it came down to ultimately is we wanted to find ourselves in the most extreme situation possible, where death was imminent and our intervention had to happen right now, that we weren't going to have resources, we weren't going to have everything that we needed, we weren't going to have help. It was just going to be us in this terrible situation, and we had to do it to the best of our ability, and we had to do it fast. And if we could do that, in our mind, that would be the perfect call.
And the patient didn't necessarily have to live, you concluded.
Yeah. And, you know, I think even, you know, I mean, it's, you know, we were being sort of cavalier about it, but even if you look, ask someone, you know, who's much more sober, they will tell you that they are not the cause of their patient's illness or injury. And should they be able to save that person, they're not the whole reason that person survived. Sometimes people simply die or live kind of regardless of what happens. So, you know, if you're not to credit 100% with the survival, then you can't be to blame 100% for the death. And so we took that to sort of its cowboy extreme and said, all right, well, you know, the patient's outcome doesn't matter as long as we do a great job in this difficult situation.
So you ran a lot of calls to really dire situations. You also ran a lot of calls to people who didn't have anything like a true medical emergency. What are the rules with regard to caring for those patients who call and turn out to be pretty much okay?
Well, in Fulton County, I know every city's different. In Fulton County in Atlanta, you know, we didn't have any choice. If you called 911, the city of Atlanta, Grady ambulance would show up, and they would have to transport you if that's what you wanted. So at 3 a.m., somebody wakes up from a nightmare, and their heart's beating. They can call 911 and say, my heart's beating. And when you get there and you say, hey, what's going on? They say, well, I just had this crazy nightmare, and I woke up and my heart is beating. Now, I think any reasonable person could hear that and say, well, do you think maybe your heart's beating because you had a nightmare? And you would say that, and they would say, I don't know, but I want to go to the hospital. And you would take them. Somebody might call and say, I've got a toothache. I need to go to the emergency room. And so you would explain, hey, look, happy to do it, but emergency rooms don't handle toothaches. So you're going to spend 13 hours in a waiting room to see a doctor who's going to say, you know, call a dentist. And they would say, all right, I'm going to take my chances anyhow. So, you know, there were people who would call for all sorts of reasons. Some of them just needed a ride downtown. And the second we got to the hospital, they'd jump out of the back door and take off. Or some had an appointment at the hospital and would go simply because now they were in the hospital and they could just leave the ER and walk up to wherever their appointment was. And you would know this was the case sometimes, but the way the law is set up in the city of Atlanta, you had to take them.
Sometimes patients are resistant to care. Sometimes they're angry. Sometimes they're even violent. How do you manage your own emotions and frustrations when you know that they need care, but they seem to do everything in their power to keep you from providing it?
You know, I always said there were sort of two, you had two selves. You had your EMS self and your normal self. If people said to me on the street when I was just walking around some of the things that they said or did to me on an ambulance, I probably would have hit them. But on an ambulance, you come to expect, just like you, if you find yourself standing over someone who's been hit by a car, you're not terribly shocked. Whereas, you know, if that happened on your day off, you know, it might surprise you a little bit. So you have a different approach to everything, including really rude, violent, drunken people. And so you, generally speaking, you would handle them almost in a way that, I don't mean to sound patronizing, but and handle that the way you kind of handle, you know, your child who's having a temper tantrum. You try to figure out, okay, why is this person so angry? Why is this person so indifferent? Why do they really... You know, why are they so insistent on not going to the hospital? It's so clear that they have to. And you would try to have, you know, just sort of reason with them and rationalize with them. Sometimes it would work. Sometimes it wasn't. You know, sometimes despite, you know, trying to be as diplomatic as you could, you find yourself in a full-blown fight in the back of an ambulance with someone who's just decided, you know, I'm angry at the world and you're the guy I'm going to take it out on.
You wrote a note to yourself during your training EMS is medicine is modern anthropology. What does that mean?
So my teacher, I had a great EMS instructor who had been in the field for a long time and really had come up with, you know, you figure paramedics weren't around until 1970. So it's, you know, still to this day being invented. But certainly when he came in, it was brand new. And so he had watched it grow. just at the same time that he had grown. And he came to the realization, correctly, I think, that you aren't simply treating your patients, but you're learning them. Because you show up with nothing but a stethoscope and a wristwatch and a little bag full of equipment, you have to rely on all of your skills. You have to, you know, to a certain degree, you know, be something of an investigator, because you aren't going to be able to do blood work or, you know, a urine sample and figure out what happened. There's no CT scan. You've got to kneel on this person's floor and try to, you know, read the bones. And that takes, you know, observing what's happening. That takes understanding. You have to have been to that particular street, to that particular project, to that particular nursing home to know, oh, these guys are known for, you know, not taking care of their patients. Or, you know, in this area, this is a part of town where they happen to do a lot of heroin. Or this is a part of town where they don't do any heroin. This is where they do crack. You know, so you'd have to know the area, know the patients, you know, to really get a big picture of everything that's happening, to understand their world as best as you can. And sometimes to speak to them, you need to speak in, you know, their language. You know, people use slang and there's different accents and different, you know, different personalities in different parts of town. And you would, you know, you'd have to best you can, try to fit in with these people to, you know, to make them trust you, but then also to understand what they're saying to you. And then when you repeat it back, there's this, you know, a flicker of recognition that you see in your face, like, oh, this isn't just some guy showing up in an ambulance. This guy's been here. He knows what he's talking about. And that, all that is building trust. And so it is sort of modern anthropology. You are being sent into this strange place, into a world that you don't understand. And you're just sort of looking around at the artifacts, looking at the evidence, trying to piece together what it means to be a part of this particular world, which is, you know, a street, a project, a nursing home. And it's a weird brand of medicine, intensely personal and totally different from one practiced anywhere else.
I don't know what your beat was when you were reporting, but, you know, if you work for a city publication, you generally get to know a lot of neighborhoods within the city. I wonder how much more intense that was when you were working as a paramedic, like what your relationship was to areas that typically like a middle-class guy wouldn't hang out in Atlanta. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I don't know that I'll ever know any place as intimately as I know Atlanta. You know, there was a stretch there where no matter what street you drove down on, I could say, hey, slow down, there's a pothole coming up in about 50 yards. Hmm. On the same time, as I drive around, you know, we went back and visited a couple of weeks ago, I can't help but look and point out to all these, you know, on that intersection, I ran this call, and that's the building that guy jumped off of, and this happened over here. And so, you know, the ghosts of the job are all around. But while I was working it, you go to these places, like you said, that nobody ever gets to go to, you know, and a lot of it with good reason. And you get to understand the people who live there. You get to appreciate some of the people who live there, have some concept of what it means to grow up there, because you see them, like some of them you deliver, and then you see them as infants, and you see it children, adolescents, adults. So you know, you get to see the entire spectrum of what life is like in that area. And, you know, you have people that trust you. And so you go into these, you know, really rough areas, and you know the people, you know the place. And, you know, friends of ours, you know, would always say, hey, you know, what's this area like? Or, you know, can you drive me through there tonight? I just want to see what's over there. You know, there's a great affinity that you have for these places that you spend so much time in, partly because, you know, you're something of the only expert around on them. And, you know, they're not yours, but because you understand them so well, you can appreciate certain aspects of it.
Ambulances, the physical vehicles, I mean, they get cleaned in between patients and that sort of thing, but they certainly, like, are witness to a lot of human drama. Do you feel any of that as you're driving around when the back of the unit is empty?
At times, you know, particularly when I was new, Grady had this fleet of old ambulances. Grady is the hospital I work for. They had this fleet of old ambulances. And you could look at them and know this thing's been driving around these streets for 12 years. You know, everything that has happened in this city has happened here. and it happens in every city. You can, you know, you see it on the news, all the things that happen, car wrecks and, you know, celebrity deaths and, you know, moments of tragedy. That ambulance is there for all of that. And the people who rode in that ambulance dealt with all of that. And now it's your turn to do that. You know, moments large and small happen every day. And you can't help but look around at an ambulance like, my gosh, you know, this thing, you know, there's so much that is happening here. So you certainly, it's almost like you can smell it. Same time, you know, it sort of dispels the notion of the haunted house, you know, because if more people have died horrible deaths in a smaller space, I don't know where it would be. And I've never seen a ghost in an ambulance. So just, you know, one of those things you're like, well, okay, maybe the notion that, you know, ghosts haunting the side of their demise is not true.
Did you feel I'm sorry, continue.
I was just going to say, I guess I can quit looking underneath the bed now.
Did you feel some kind of withdrawal after you left?
No, I didn't, because I think I had, the job had worked its course for me. I know people who left early who really miss it. I know people who left and have returned because, you know, in no other aspect of life does somebody, you know, fall off a roof and is it your job to go and fix it. So a lot of people have had that, but for me, I think it had run its course, and I thought, you know, I was proud of the work that I did and I was glad that I did it, but it was time for me to move on. Now, there are certain aspects of it until the day I die, I will, you know, miss sitting around on a cool late spring evening when the sky is clear and you're with your favorite partner and it's Friday night and you can just feel this energy coming off the streets and you know that it's going to be crazy tonight. You know everything is going to happen. And you're going to be the one sent out to deal with it. You know, and you hear the people talking and you hear laughing, and somewhere in the distance you hear a gunshot, and then another part of town you sort of hear the distant wail of a siren, and, you know, in some parts of town there's a sort of bird-like communication that criminals and drug dealers have, and you sort of hear their whoops and their calls, and you're sitting there in this ambulance, you know, the windows down. It's an intoxicating feeling. I will miss that, but you know, that's only a portion of it. A lot of it is other stuff, and so, you know, I think I did what I did.
Writer Kevin Hazard worked for 9 years as a paramedic in Atlanta. His new book is called 1,000 Naked Strangers, A Paramedic's Wild Ride to the Edge and Back. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me on. It's been great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.